Mitch McConnell. Although 10 senators did join Mitch McConnell, no Republicans voted in favor of the bill itself, which temporarily increases the debt limit until December and did not require GOP votes to pass. Newsweek has reached out to Mitch McConnell's office for comment. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, delivered a speech blasting Republicans for partisan brinkmanship just after the 11 GOP senators joined with Democrats to end debate on the bill and allow the vote to move forward. "Republicans played a dangerous and risky partisan game, and I'm glad that their brinkmanship did not work," Senator Chuck Schumer said. He added, "For the good of American families, for the good of our economy, Republicans must recognize in the future that they should approach fixing the debt limit in a bipartisan way." Leader Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans insisted they wanted a solution to the debt ceiling, but said Democrats must raise it alone by going through a drawn-out, convoluted, and risky reconciliation process, he added. "That was simply unacceptable to my caucus." And yesterday, Senate Republicans finally realized that their obstruction was not going to work. Senator Chuck Schumer's speech reportedly infuriated a number of Republicans who had allowed the vote to move forward. It also rankled Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, who told reporters that he didn't think it was appropriate at this time.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what are the secrets of the spiritual wayfaring, humility, and how they apply to our ubudiyya, our servitude of Allah? So, dear listeners, talking about the secrets of the spiritual wayfaring, which is really another name for the servitude of Allah, the ubudiyya of Allah. Now, this spiritual wayfaring is a journey which every single one of us has to take in our lives. Of course, it is a spiritual journey that we have to take if we want to become near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if we want to attain the qurb, the nearness of Allah. So the salik, which is the Arabic word for the person who is conducting this spiritual wayfaring, the spiritual wayfarer, the salik, that is moving towards Allah, has to recognize their state of humility and place that humility of servitude and the glory of the lordship, the rububiyya of Allah, before their eyes. Now, again, as we've talked in previous programs, humility, humbleness, this down-to-earth persona that a human being has is what helps one to excel in this spiritual wayfaring, in this attaining nearness to their Creator, to Allah. Now, the stronger this viewpoint is, the stronger this concept is within a human being, this state of humility and the humility of servitude is considered, the more spiritual their worship becomes and the stronger the spirit of their worship is. So humility, again, for a spiritual wayfarer is an integral and most important part of their process of spiritual wayfaring. Now, of course, if one continues in this spiritual wayfaring, the more spiritual their worship becomes, then the stronger the spirit of their worship becomes, until, with the help of Allah and the awliya of Allah, the close ones to Allah, a person reaches the truth of servitude and its core, meaning a person will witness a glimpse of the secrets of worship, the secrets of servitude, and the secrets of ubudiyya. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Nami Farhat Al-Ameli.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A lot of youth are turning to religion, but some of them become very extreme. They start interpreting verses and narrations and coming up with their own theories that are not based on any solid evidence, but rather on the weak understanding of religion. And the moment you disagree with them, they start attacking you. This is a problem, but it is never too late to change. What you need to do before you start memorizing information is to work on your spirituality, to clean yourself through losing your ego. Reading is very important, but it's not enough. It is like you have a cup of water in front of you. You read how tasty the water is, how pure it is. Reading can give you some information about the water, but it doesn't make you taste the water. When you work on your spirituality, when you work on cleaning yourself and destroying your ego, you will get a chance to taste how pure the water is. And when this water goes down into your heart, it will remove extremism and it will fill your heart with love to everyone. It will make you accept everyone, even those who you disagree with. It will make you open up to everyone, to love good for everyone, because religion is nothing other than love. Lose your ego to win yourself. Understand that you are nothing to receive everything. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In continuation to what we were talking about, which was how a salik, a spiritual wayfarer, has to have this concept of humility and also has to regard the humility of servitude before them in order to truly reach the heights of servitude. Of course, the stronger a person's worship becomes, the more spiritual their servitude of Allah, their ubudiyah becomes, then the stronger the spirit of that ubudiyah and that servitude of Allah becomes as well. It's interesting, but when talking about a salik, a spiritual wayfarer, a person who is on this path and on this spiritual journey to attain the nearness of Allah and attain the qurb of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, we find that in the Holy Quran, in Surah An-Nisa, which is chapter number 4 and verse number 100, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "And whoever leaves his house migrating to Allah and His Messenger, and then death overtakes them, their reward is indeed with Allah." So here, dear friends, in this verse of the Holy Quran, we find that a person who leaves their house, right, and they are migrating towards Allah and Allah's Messenger, meaning they are moving towards Allah, they are on this spiritual journey, they are a salik, which is moving towards Allah for the sake of Allah, on the path of Allah. And while they are in this migration towards Allah, death overtakes them, then the reward that they will receive is something which only Allah knows. And so in this spiritual wayfaring, in this road and this journey towards Allah, which is really the ultimate purpose of every single one of our lives, this migrating towards Allah, this walking the path which leads to Allah via righteous deeds and good deeds and the commandments of Islam and the commandments of humanity, one reaches this ultimate perfection. And even if they were to not reach that ultimate perfection, for death overtakes every single one of us, even if death were to overtake this individual, their reward is with Allah. So the important point is to keep trying, to keep moving towards Allah, to continue this spiritual wayfaring, and to continue our ubudiyah and our servitude of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. Welcome back, dear friends. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. In the previous two segments, dear friends, we talked about the secrets of the salik, the spiritual wayfarer, this journey which every single one of us must take towards Allah. And we talked about the very integral and important role which humility plays in all of this. Of course, without humility, the spiritual wayfarer, the person who is on this journey towards Allah, will never reach their destination. And of course, all of these things come under the circle of ubudiyah, the servitude of Allah. We also talked about the verse from the Holy Quran, which was chapter number 4, Surah An-Nisa, verse number 100, where Allah talks about those people who leave their house migrating towards Allah and His Messenger. And then if death was to overtake them, Allah is the one who will give them their reward, meaning their reward is truly something which only Allah knows. Again, the importance of moving towards Allah in our lives. Here we talk about at the end this idea about loving the self, And one of the greatest idols which a person has is not necessarily the idols outside, but they are the idols inside. And so as long as a human being has their eyes on their own self and their imagined beauty and their imagined perfection, they will always be veiled and discarded from the absolute beauty of Allah and the pure perfection of Allah. And so we find in the words of Imam Khomeini, the esteemed, that the first condition for traveling to Allah is to leave this house of the self. He says, actually, it is the criterion for the struggle between right and wrong. And so, dear friends, every salik, every spiritual wayfarer who travels with the steps of selfishness and self-conceit and is wrapped in the veils of egotism, their suffering and their working towards this path of Allah would be in vain, and their journey would not be towards Allah, rather it would be towards their self. Again, if an individual is wrapped in the veils of selfishness and self-conceit and egotism and I-ness, then how do you or me, how does anyone expect to be able to reach Allah if they are trying to reach themselves? It's interesting, but there is this beautiful piece of poetry by the Persian poet by the name of Maulawi. And so Maulawi, he says that the mother of the idols is the idol of yourself. For those are mere snakes, but this is a dragon. And so very interesting here, he says that the mother of the idols, meaning all other idols, and then he says are mere snakes. They're small, they're relatively inconsequential. They are dangerous, just as snakes are dangerous. But then he says that the mother of all idols, the greatest of all idols, is yourself. And when compared to snakes, this idol of the self is a dragon. Huge, great, big dragon. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
A visit to Iran yields a stunning variety of culinary delights. There is a vast spectrum of foods flourishing for centuries and evolving since Achaemenid times. Persian cooking incorporates many flavors into its uniquely delicious food traditions. A taste of Persia's food can be identified by its sumptuous rice dishes, its intriguing and delicate flavors, and its combination of herbs, spice, fruit, and nuts. And one integral component to Persian cuisine is the use of saffron, the world's most expensive spice, which gives Iranian food its distinct flavor and aroma and golden hue. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Many coveted ingredients are native to Iran, including pistachios, almonds, walnuts, pomegranates, grapes, and perhaps most notably, saffron. Iran has a variable climate with four distinct seasons. The ancient Persians transformed vast stretches of arid land into fertile oases through underground aquifers that drew melted snow water into the desert. And thus, a bright, sensuous, fruit and herb-filled cuisine was born. This week on Aperture, we will follow Javad Gharoyi as he explores the amazing deserts of South Khorasan province and visits a charming little village where saffron, the world's most highly prized spice, is grown. Don't miss the first part.
This time, I leave the cold winter weather in the capital city for the beautiful desert flower farms. My destination is the outskirts of South Khorasan province, an area famous for its saffron, Iran's prized red gold. Iran is one of the most mountainous countries in the world, covered by rugged mountain ranges and deserts. 61% of the country has a dry climate. Deserts cover a combined area of around 34 million hectares, scattered among 18 of its provinces. That means around 30% of the country is made up of vast deserts featuring many mountains, salt pans, and sand dunes. Deserts across the world share almost the same features: little precipitation, intense evaporation of water due to the scorching sun, smothering heat, dry air, great temperature fluctuations, poor vegetation, and a dearth of adequate organic compounds in the soil. However, despite the hostile climate of the deserts of Iran, life is in progress on their margins. I'm Javad Gharoyi. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm taking you on a journey to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and showing you their many beauties. Before visiting the saffron grove, I decide to take a look around at the desert surroundings on the outskirts of South Khorasan province. To that end, I begin my journey with Halwan Desert, located within 90 kilometers of Tabas, a city in and the capital of Tabas County, in the northwest of South Khorasan. Because of its distance from the urban areas, the natural beauties of deserts are not known to humans as much as they should. If you want to venture out into the desert in order to admire its matchless beauties, you'd have to choose the right season and the right time of day. From a distance, deserts and the wilderness don't seem all that beautiful. Once you've set foot in them, you feel as if you've stepped into a veritable heaven. What a different kind of heaven. You don't see forests with tall trees, grass, or running water. All you can see is streams with very salty water, single salt cedars and saxoles, scattered shrubs and bushes in the landscape, camels and other species unique to this hot and dry climate. It's very beautiful and peaceful here, but that's not always the case. Within minutes, this whole area can turn into an ominously stormy ocean. Ferocious storms of sand and dust that have buried many a caravan and traveler over the course of centuries. In the not-too-distant past, some of Iran's deserts were inhabited by people living in this climate. But thanks to global warming and decreased precipitation that led to drinking water wells drying and parts of the vegetation dying, the people living in such areas were forced to leave their little villages for a better place. Today, those villages lay in ruins on their original locations. Ruins that now serve as shelters for the camel herders against the blazing sun. But these homes of yesterday are still as beautiful as ever. Deserts around the world are expanding by the year. Desert expansion or desertification is a result of global warming, the growth in the human population, unplanned agriculture and excessive firewood collection, depletion of subterranean water resources, industrial contaminants and excessive use of fossil fuels, overgrazing by livestock, and the change in the use of agricultural land. This conversion of habitable and fertile land to uninhabitable desert can happen naturally due to a drought, or can be caused by human activities. Activities that have disturbed the balance of nature on planet Earth. Iran accounts for more than 2% of the world's drought. It's also home to more than 8% of the deserts and arid lands that contain no vegetation, and that is considered a big number. But in the fringes of this same hot and dry desert, meaning the one in South Khorasan, there are mountains that supply the rivers and qanats in this area with drinking water. Streams that could be regarded as the natural wonders of this otherwise parched region. Taht-e-Arus, or the Bride's Throne, near the village of Izmiran on the Tabas-Mashhad Road, is a befitting name for this stream. The flowing water reminds me of the celebrations held by people in the old times upon the discovery of clean, fresh water in a hot and dry region. Only those born and bred in a dry climate with limited resources of fresh water appreciate its true value. People who have endured thirst, have felt the baking heat from the sun on their skin, and may have seen rain coming down from the skies over their heads only once a year. The people of Izmiran fit that profile perfectly. God has bestowed upon them fresh water in a stream gushing out of the dry desert mountains around Tebas. And the people here have utmost appreciation for this most precious of God's blessings in the heart of the natural world. In the distant past, the people of Izmiran lived in dwellings carved into mountain wall. With the tools they had, they would dig deep vertical and horizontal holes into the side of the mountains. In them, they'd carve out rooms where they'd live. In the past, these hand-carved chambers were referred to as looms. Desert people are very smart. Using the water from the stream and the fertile soil here, they've been farming rice for generations. Today, the rice produced in Izmiran is among the best in the country. Who would believe there are paddy fields in the middle of a desert and among these mountains? Everybody thinks rice is only grown in the north of Iran. But where does the stream go on this dry land? After irrigating the paddy fields of Izmiran, does it sink into the arid terrain in the areas surrounding the rice farms? That can't be the case, because to the desert dwellers, fresh water is worth more than diamonds. The locals in this area have spoken to me of a formidable yet beautiful canyon and helped me see the rest of the course that the water from Takhtiaru Spring takes. The name of that canyon is Kali Jenny, the Canal of Jinns, shaped by water movement and erosion over centuries. I'm going to step into a canyon where the water from Takhtiaru Spring is flowing, but the volume of the water is not large enough to make it to the end of this very long course without going to waste. I'm curious to know how that water continues on its path in the dry land and where it eventually gets to. It's simply beautiful. As I said, the name of the awe-inspiring canyon is Kali Jenny. On its bottom, water from the Takhtiaru Spring of Tabaz is moving as we speak. Most of the way, the water flows between the two walls of this canyon, just like it does in Akhanat, and springs out of the underground near Tabaz. It's one of the most beautiful sights to see around the city of Tabaz in South Khorasan province. The Canal of Jinns. That's a scary name. Kali Jenny was shaped so beautifully by water movements, such as seasonal rain-induced floodwaters over thousands or millions of years. It kind of looks like the Grand Canyon in the U.S., though it doesn't share the same depth. It really is stunning. After a long walk in the mountains, I arrive at the upper end of the canyon. From up here, it's a spectacular deep gorge. I explore the canyon as much as I can, and as long as there is nothing to threaten my life. But as I walk the length of it, water from Takhtiaru Spring is nowhere to be found most of the way. The locals have already given me valuable information about that, but to see everything firsthand, I have to walk down to the bottom of the valley, and I do so with gusto and caution. One of the things that renders Kali Jenny even more remarkable is its pristineness. Not many nature travelers come here, and fortunately those who do don't leave behind any kind of waste or garbage. And that has turned this canyon into one of the most must-see natural sites in the Tabaz area. There are Ghanats here. In some places, water has pushed its way out, but there are still other Ghanats inside walls that continue all the way to the villages of Tabaz. And this water originates from the Takhtiaru Spring in Esmeran province. It's the same water that's come all the way here and has welled out. In the absence of plumbing in the past, they would channel fresh water from one village to another or from the mountains to their villages and farms by means of a canal system, and they did it to prevent the water from going to waste. This one here is one of those ghanats. Out on the bottom of the canyon, the water would sink into the ground. So they channeled the water downhill through a series of gently sloping tunnels along several kilometers to the places where it was needed for irrigation and domestic use. Although new ghanats are seldom built today, many old ones are still used in Iran, and have until recently served as one of the main reasons behind the continuation of life in areas with hot and dry climates. New technology has in recent years led to a rapid depletion of the underground water reservoirs, but we can still think of reviving the Ghanat water supply system, take advantage of this millennia-old experience for agricultural purposes in Iran, and do something to make it happen. I knew very well that the rainfall in the eastern regions of the country is less than half the rain that falls in the western regions. Therefore, water is much more valuable in this part of the country. The people living in these parts have always been thinking of innovative ways of harnessing water and managing its resources. Digging ghanats and channeling underground water onto the surface was very common in Iran. They didn't cost much, and they were very efficient. Ghanats offered several advantages. Firstly, they prevent the sun from shining directly at the water and making it evaporate. Secondly, moving inside the mountains, not much of the water is absorbed by the bedding walls of the channel. And thirdly, the water is immune to any and all kinds of contamination and flows to its destination clean and cool. What's certain is that humans wouldn't have been able to survive in the desert areas if they hadn't built the Ghanats. Almost all researchers believe that the world's first Ghanats were built in areas under Iran's cultural influence. No one knows for sure why the ancient dwellers of this region named this gorge the Kali Jinni, but apparently some of them believe this canyon was haunted by jinns or ghosts. There were others who believed the idea of digging holes and caves into the mountainside for safety was something that even ghosts wouldn't have been able to come up with. Or maybe the reason why this canyon was named the Canal of Jinns was the roaring seasonal floodwaters that swept along this canyon and still do today. Whatever the name, it must have been chosen for a reason. It defies belief that there is so much water in the Kali Jinni Canyon. To the people of southern Khorasan province, each drop of this water is worth as much as a kilo of saffron, and this canyon has a lot of it. It looks like someone has chiseled away at the rocks. The only sound you can hear in the mountains is that of the water rippling along the Ghanats. Eventually, I get to a point in the canyon where the ancient dwellers of this land redirected the water from the surface to a canal inside the mountain. This is where the water is redirected underground. It was the brainchild of folks who lived here in the distant past, and that beautiful Ghanat duck inside the wall of the canyon carries this water to the villages lying on the outskirts of Tabas. The locals have told me different things about the cavities and man-made holes inside the Kali Jinni. Apparently, no one has accurate information on the age of those cave-like shelters. But tales of how they came to be have been passed down from one generation to another. I spend hours scouring the canyon for those man-made tunnels, and I finally find them. It is hard to believe how these tunnels were hand-carved at this height. Niches that acted as footholds to help them climb some 5 or 6 meters to get to the chambers above, where they are likely to have lived. And that was where they felt safe. It's still not clear why these tunnels, these wells and these chambers were dug into the walls of this canyon and at this height by the people in the past. But many believe they actually lived here. This was the perfect place for people to take shelter in and survive the stifling heat of the Tabas region. And there are many others who believe this was a place where the village dwellers around here, who wanted to steer clear of the brigands and looters, would transfer all their valuable belongings. They themselves would hide here too, along with their belongings, and wait for the looters to leave the area. Of course, there are also others who are of the opinion that these tunnels were just the right place for the people of that time to come to and worship their gods. That in fact, they considered this place as their place of worship. They call it the Canal of Jinns for a reason. It can get really scary in some parts. And it's obvious that torrential floodwaters have shaped this valley like this over the years. In fact, what those floodwaters did was wash away the dirt and stones on their path. Of course, it might have taken millions of years for this canyon to take on the shape it has today. It's frightening to be here and walking on the bottom flanked by tall walls. It looks endless to me. I've been walking these smaller gorges near Kali Jinni for hours, but it looks like there is no end in sight. I haven't been able to get to the other end of any of them. The deeper you go inside, you realize you have more to go. This is a completely virgin valley with no traces whatsoever of human activity in it. Usually, garbage is the first sign of human presence in the natural world. It's clear to me that only people who feel responsible to nature have been to this area before. That is because there is no trash on the ground and no writings on the walls. That has made my trip into the heart of the canyon ever more worthwhile and helped me appreciate its magnificence more intensely. My visit to the Collegiate Canyon has come to an end. I got to see beautiful sights in the canyon from different angles. The canyon has a scary name, but that didn't change my mind about traveling right into it and exploring it. I continue my trek in the desert, this time to see the desert flower, commonly known as the saffron crocus. That means an approximately 200-kilometer walking distance from the Collegiate Canyon. On my way there, the imposing ruins of an ancient building grab my attention. They are the remains of a desolate village by the name of Dihuk. Iranian deserts always have wonderful surprises for travelers, and this beautiful ancient village is one of them. What really tugs at my heartstrings, though, is that the villagers have abandoned these buildings with their unique architecture for brick-and-mortar homes. It saddens me to see traditional Iranian architecture consigned to oblivion by my fellow Iranians in cities and villages. Today, Iranian architecture that encompasses life and vitality, art and aesthetic beauties, and love and positive energy is being replaced by ghastly steel and mortar structures. Architecture that's alien to the Persian culture. Architecture that bears no signs of the ancient Persian culture and doesn't include the freshness, the gardens, the water pools, and other natural features characteristic of traditional Persian architecture. Such homes do not belong in our country, and I wish they'd never been built. In my opinion, this ancient village is one of the most beautiful villages I've ever seen in this area. The people here, I mean the people who used to live here, call this village Ancient Dihuk. Now, they live in a small township by the same name, built around 20 to 25 years ago. It was built after the earthquake in the year 1978. So now they call this place Old Dihuk, which, as I say, is one of the most beautiful villages on the margins of the Lut Desert.
Russia has sent an actress and a director to space to make the world's first movie in orbit. The crew blasted off from Kazakhstan for the International Space Station along with a cosmonaut and successfully reached the orbit. They spent 4 months on preparation for the flight. After 12 days in space, they will return to Earth. The movie, named Challenge, is about a doctor who goes to the space station to treat an astronaut with a heart ailment. Russian officials say the project will help burnish the nation's space glory. Australian scientists have developed artificial structures that act as a much-needed habitat for marine life.
Extremely exciting because we have seen a total of more than 90 species colonizing these diverse panels, and we see 30 to 40% more species on the panels in the living seawalls than on the unmodified parts of the seawall, so the seawalls with no panels. So that's extremely exciting, and really gives us confidence to scale this up to other environments and other artificial structures.
The project has installed over 1,000 artificially designed panels onto seawalls in Sydney. These craggy concrete panels are 3D printed and designed to last for at least 20 years. Only a short time after installation, they turned into a cozy new home for the fish, crustaceans, and other marine life.
So we have more fish in Sydney Harbour than we have in the entire UK coast. So we have more than 500 species of fish in the harbor, so that's quite impressive. But what we notice is that urbanization and the human settling, especially towards the coast, has a lot of impacts on this amazing marine environment, and that's what we are trying to mitigate a bit with the living seawalls by attaching these panels that mimic natural features such as rocky shores and rock pools and crevices and nooks and crannies.
After becoming popular in Australia, the panels were also installed in Wales and Singapore. The scientists say since the installation of these panels, the quality of Sydney's harbour water has improved. They hope coastal structures built in the future would be ecologically sustainable, designed not only for humans, but for nature. The Greek Postal Service has come up with an innovative idea to speed up the mail sorting process, not by humans, but a fleet of robots. 55 tiny yellow robots powered by artificial intelligence are helping employees in Hellenic Post Sorting Center. They scan postal codes to identify the bundle's destination, weigh the parcels, and put them in related platforms. The program aims to handle increasing number of packages from online shopping, especially during the pandemic.
The end result is a threefold increase in sorting speed of parcels, ensuring next day delivery for our customers. These autonomous mobile robots are energy efficient, thus directly reducing the energy consumption of the sorting process, and that way allowing us to take a greener approach to operations.
According to the company, up to 80% of mail sorting has been passed to the four-wheeled robots. Each day, these little machines manage around 168,000 packages weighing up to 15 kilograms. Every 4 hours, they need recharging, which takes 5 minutes.
Plastic pollution has become one of the most pressing environmental issues as disposable products overwhelm the world's ability to deal with them. Indonesian activists have come up with an idea to convince people to rethink their habits and say no to single-use bags and bottles. Environmentalists have created a museum made entirely from plastic waste in the town of Gresing in East Java. It took them 3 months to collect used plastic items, ranging from bottles and bags to sachets and straws. They were all assembled from polluted rivers and beaches. The centerpiece of this museum is a statue whose skirt is made from single-use sachets of household items. The museum has become a popular location for selfies and has received more than 400 visitors since it opened last month.
I will definitely change my life habits. For example, like when I go to the market or to a grocery store that provides a plastic bag, I will switch to a tote bag. And when I buy a drink, I will use a tumbler.
Environmentalists say the plan behind the exhibition was to send a message about the world's worsening ocean plastic crisis. The plastic problem is particularly acute in Indonesia, a nation that ranks second only behind China for its volume of plastics that end up in the seas.
People around the world celebrate the changing seasons in different ways. In the U.S., an annual pumpkin contest is held to kick off the fall season. Each year, farmers and vegetable enthusiasts from across the U.S. gather in New England for the competition. Anyone bringing the largest homegrown pumpkin gets the prize. This year, a man from Abington, Connecticut, got the prize for his pumpkin weighing more than 2,000 pounds. Alex Noel explains how he worked hard to produce that giant pumpkin.
A nearly unlimited amount of work goes into producing a 2,000-pound-plus pumpkin. I put about 1,000 hours a season into 2 to 3 giant pumpkins, and you're lucky to even get that many by the end of the year. I'm out there watering, fertilizing, keeping excess water off if it's too rainy, which it was this year, spraying insecticides, spraying fungicides, pruning, training vines, propping up leaves at the end of the season, putting blankets on when it's cold out, heating cables, fans. I mean, the list goes on and on.
The New England Giant Pumpkin Weigh-Off began at the Tufts Field Fair in 1984. That year, the winner showcased a pumpkin weighing 196 kilograms. The Way Up has received worldwide recognition too. Syria's ancient city of Aleppo seems getting a taste of normalcy amid reconstruction efforts and the war-ravaged city. A Syrian historian has also been contributing to make the city regain its lost glory. Ala al-Sayed is working to faithfully restore the lost sections of Aleppo's old city. For that, he is using documents and clippings he himself saved during the early years of the conflict. He says he came up with the idea to digitalize those documents in 2013. Then he embarked on organizing newspapers, books, and pamphlets while scanning each one to add to his digital library. Following the liberation of Aleppo, Ala came back to the city and started renovating historic places which are on the World Heritage List.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The North Dublin suburb of Howth has a new highly efficient firefighting crew. The group has 25 members, but none of them are human.
Howth was targeted by a lot of fire, and so there's a lot of gorse here, and it's prone, it's very flammable. The goats, on the other hand, love gorse, so it's a win-win in that sense. I suppose the project also focuses on the old Irish goat and defining their role as a functional biodiversity crew. They're a hard-working crew, they're up for the job, they're keen to do it. It also instills key conservation grazing principles to tackle fire prevention and habitat management and the control of invasive species. So it's the old Irish ladies that have the job to do here and are well able to do it.
The goats graze eagerly on the ample gorse bushes, which are highly inflammable and cause blazes in hot weather. The local council hopes their deployment will make Howth less susceptible to wildfires. Conservationists also hope that the project will contribute to the survival of the old Irish goats, which almost went extinct in the last century. Each member of the herd has a box around their neck with a built-in GPS device. If the goats stray too far, the gadget will ping and let the owner know.
Five Siberian tiger cubs born in a South Korean zoo have made their first public debut. The cubs were born at Everland Theme Park in Yongin in late June. Their birth brought joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts as they are listed as endangered species. Zookeepers say it's unusual for Siberian tigers to give birth to five babies at once. South Korean people selected the cubs' names through an online vote. Many exotic fruit plants need the tropical climate to grow, but Assyrian is producing nearly 100 types of tropical fruits at his backyard in a coastal city of Tartus. Mohammed Hassan's passion for agriculture is to the extent that he left his job in media to build a farm. He managed to create a tropical environment at his compound, and that was the reason behind his success in growing fruits that are rare in many parts of the world. In fact, he has turned his farm into what he likes to be described as a tropical cave.
I came across the world of tropical fruits as some of them existed here. Many immigrants also helped me on this path. They bought me special varieties from India, South America, the Caribbean and other countries, even China. Currently, we grow 93 types of fruits.
Hassan's success has encouraged other Tartus residents to create their own farms. The government is also assisting Hassan with his unique business. His farm is now open to tourists and visitors where they can taste the products. Hassan says He has bigger plans for the future and is thinking about using his tropical environment to raise and breed rainforest animals. In Brazil, paleontologists have discovered the fossilized remains of a dinosaur that lived roughly 70 million years ago.
It's a bipedal dinosaur with short arms, around 5 meters long, and it was at the top of the food chain in the period in which it lived. It was the predator at the time.
Paleontologists say the fossil suggests a dinosaur species known as Gurupi Itata was a meat eater. They found the ancient predator's remains at one of Brazil's richest sites for dinosaur findings in the city of Sao Paulo. The first piece of Gurupi Itata's fossil was unearthed during an excavation work in 2002. Until the completion of the research, a model of this species would be on display at Monte Alto's Museum of Paleontology. Experts believe the discovery would help scientists better understand paleontology on Brazilian lands. Most of us know the feeling of being moved by a work of art. A Kosovo artist tries to make us understand a form of political discourse through a mosaic of outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Alkent Apajogo has made a Merkel mosaic from seeds. The artist says he wished to thank the German leader for having been an example for all the women of the world. He says his work is also a tribute to the towering lady for the support she had given to his country, which declared its independence in 2008. Pajago was doing his work on the same day Germans were voting in the general elections to choose a successor to Merkel. Alkan Pajago holds 2 Guinness World Records for his giant mosaics made with seeds.
Technology plays an important role in our daily lives. This time, a French company has introduced a device to help the visually impaired to avoid obstacles. The smart electronic device detects obstacles and warns users with a beep. People with vision loss can install it on the top of their canes and receive information through headphones. The gadget helps people to dodge barriers on the ground and above that, for example, the open door of a truck.
If you hear the sound to the right, it means that the obstacle is on the right. If it is straight ahead, the obstacles are in front of you. So you change course according to what you hear. If you hear an obstacle to the left, you go to the right, and this way you can go around the obstacle.
The device costs around $2,300 and is now being used by hundreds of people in Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland.
Wally the Walrus has risen to fame with his extensive travels around Europe. Now the giant mammal has added Iceland to his list of trips. Wally has previously visited France, Spain and the UK. His last known location before Iceland was Ireland. Scientists were not sure at first if they had indeed seen Wally, but Seal Rescue Ireland recognized him from scars on his front flippers. The wandering walrus is 4 years old and weighs about a ton. He has covered a distance of around 5,000 kilometers in his recent trips. Wally is now on his way towards his home in the Arctic. A French zoo has had a very productive year, welcoming multiple new animals into its collection. 2 pumas, 2 jaguars, 9 Peruvian squirrel monkeys, and even rarer macaque twins are new additions to Lemingne Zoo this summer. The animals were bred as part of a program designed to maintain and promote the conservation of endangered species. Once they reach the breeding age, these animals will be transported to other zoos to help boost the population of their species.
www.parstoday.com/en